Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the collapse of the UN-brokered Syrian peace talks in Geneva that just began and are now supposed to be resumed on February the 25th. Dr. Mazen Sawaf, a member of the Syrian National Council and a member of the opposition delegation that met recently in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to select the HNC, the High Negotiating Committee for the UN peace talks, joins us. With France accusing the Syrian government and Russia of torpedoing the talks by unleashing a massive Russian bombing campaign in conjunction with Hezbollah, Iranian and Syrian government forces cutting off a key supply route to the rebel-held city of Aleppo, we'll discuss the role of the U.S. in these talks that many in the region feel is disingenuous, as the U.S. still insists that Assad has to go while appearing to give Russia a free hand to bomb the opposition. Then we will speak with Jonathan Taplin, the director of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, who has an article at the Huffington Post, "Iowa Caucus Deals Death Blow to the Establishment." We'll discuss how we are trapped between a dying establishment and a new order that is not quite formed. And while change is coming, it has to survive the last gasp of America's plutocrats who are invested in either Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, lowering their taxes, stopping efforts to address global warming, and throwing more money at the Pentagon. Then finally, we'll examine the critical situation in the key Middle East country of Jordan following King Abdullah's warning that his country has reached a boiling point from hosting a million refugees from Syria that have strained public services and infrastructure, costing 25% of the state's budget. Gillian Schwedler, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, joins us to discuss when Jordan will reach the breaking point. And joining us now is Dr. Mazen Sawaf, who's a member of the Syrian National Council, a member of the delegation that met recently in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to select the negotiating team for the UN Syrian peace talks that were suspended today in Geneva. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mazen Sawaf.
Hello.
Hello. The peace talks look like they've collapsed, but the UN are insisting that they have been suspended. So what's your understanding, since you were a member of the delegation that chose the HNC, the High Negotiating Committee?
I'm an American, first of all. I go by Dr. Max. And I am also originally from Syria. I went to medical school there. So I left Syria. I was 23. I know quite a bit of about Syria. Of course, I'm happy that they suspended the talks. The delegation is about 28 people. Less than 10 are in favor of continuing the talks when the Russians are intensifying their targeting hospitals, schools, civilians, etc., and making the negotiations about stopping this the targeting of civilians. This is a United Nations resolution that Russia signed and agreed to a couple of months ago. And repeatedly we said that this is not a negotiating point. And their counter is, you cannot come to negotiations with precondition. We're saying this is a United Nations resolution that was agreed to by all nations, that you cannot use civilians, innocent women and children, as hostages, and prevent, I mean, if you take a hostage, you have to feed them, and they're not feeding them or allowing anybody to feed them. So I have a lot of respect for Secretary Kerry and his team, but I'm very disappointed with his recent actions as he presides over the biggest genocide since World War II that is happening today in Syria, and especially the recent intensifying of that genocide. He said in Davos just two weeks ago, we look forward to a world where we do not need memorials for genocide. Yet he concluded a deal with Lavrov whereby Assad can stay in power for next 2 years, then he can run for re-elections. That's what the Russians want. A war criminal that President Obama said 5 years ago that he is not he's illegitimate, that he shall not allow him to cross the red line, meaning using chemical weapons against civilians. Now he's allowing Assad to use those negotiations to turn about to become the letting children, physicians who are in jail for being caught with band-aids and tortured to death, etc. He's using that as a bargaining chip. Syria today is a big prison. You know, nobody's allowed to leave. If anybody is between 18 to 35, male is caught, they force him to go and fight with Assad. We call anybody who uses hostages a terrorist, and they usually have to feed them. They are not only they are not feeding them as a government, they are not allowing the United Nations or NGOs to feed them. So they had in Madaya, which is like a city 45 minutes from Damascus, I used to spend my summers there because it's in a mountainous area. The people, 40,000 people, were having to eat grass, live on cats, cooking, you know, using cats to get their protein, things like that. And then we had a snow recently that covered all the grass, etc. So people started dying. And the media got some of the pictures that are so grotesque that moved people, and there was some pressure, so they allowed some convoys to go, got like a month's supply for those 40,000 people for 1 month to get some food. And now there are 14 other areas in Syria under siege, some 500,000 people. And beside all that targeting and bombing, etc., we said never again we'd allow innocent people to be sent to a furnace. Yet Assad is dropping barrel bombs, which is like a furnace, on those people who are in prison. The whole Syria is a big prison. And now the Russians are using more sophisticated bombs than the $27 barrel bomb of TNT, which was dropped by the 35 Syrian helicopters that Assad have remaining with him, slow-moving, that anything can take them out. We can take them out in 1 hour, because they are killing civilians and creating all this refugee crisis and destabilizing the whole nation. Yet now our position is that we'll allow elections to bring another Hitler to power. We are allowing another Hitler to run for re-election with his 17 security agencies running everything in Syria, because Russia wants its naval base. The U.S. wants a strong regime to deal with to prevent Islamists from taking over the country and threatening our ally Israel, which has rightly is concerned about the failed nation that is next door.
Well, given that, what you just said, though, I mean, you can't, if the choice is between Assad and the Islamic State, you can understand why people aren't necessarily supporting the opposition. I mean, is there a third part? Dr. Max Awaf, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Dr. Max Awaf, who's a member of the Syrian National Council and a member of the delegation that met recently in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to select the negotiating team for the UN Syrian peace talks that were suspended today in Geneva. So just address that, if you will, that Israel's concerned about a failed state next door, yeah, and the choice between Assad and the Islamic State, and whether there's another choice.
I'm an anesthesiologist trained at Boston University. In medicine, anytime you have a complication or you have preventive problems, we do what we call RCA, root cause analysis. So we look at the root cause of refugees, extremism, genocide, etc. And today, Assad is the reason for ISIS. He let them out of prisons, him and Maliki in Iraq, and let them become strong, etc. The Syrian people are non-sectarians. They lived with the Christians and the Jews in Syria for thousands of years. We have churches that stayed intact. We lived with, I went to school in a French Christian school. We had in Damascus, etc. So the people in Syria are not Wahhabis. This is foreign to us. We are, as a culture, we value education, and we don't have this Wahhabi thinking or etc. The second is the what by us letting this happen, we are driving people to extreme measures. When they are starving to death, we are bombing their hospitals and targeting it, etc., because you want to kill them. The Assad is now putting us in this place of where choose me or ISIS that I created, you know? We don't have to have that choice. We want a democratic, united, non-sectarian, free country and free of fear. We live in fear because of those agencies, etc. Why should it be that we are not allowed to have all our money and resources in rebuilding Syria, which is now bombed to a stone age, and spend on education instead of forcing all the countries in the Middle East to buy arms so that they defend themselves from the strong regime in Iran that wants to export their revolution and become the police of the Middle East and allow them to dominate the area.
But given that these peace talks were long in coming and had just barely begun, nobody had actually met, and the Syrian government is saying, we showed up, but the other side walked out. I understand the UN had a precondition on relieving the humanitarian disasters where people are being starved. And now they've broken down. So if you can't even get to the point of talking, all of what you're talking about is never going to be addressed, is it? I mean,
I think there is a tacit agreement between Secretary Kerry and Lavrov that Russia will do the dirty work of the bombing and killing, etc., so that they weaken the rebels to where they would sign to such unfair deals where we allow a criminal to stay in power instead of taking him to trial. And then to run for re-election after 45 years of him and his dad running the country. So we are basically not putting enough heat, letting it happen, etc. We pretend to be upset, but the deal is this: they sold out the opposition. They want it weakened enough to accept terms that Lavrov is imposing, because now Putin is Alexander the Great, and he's so powerful because of the leading from behind weak Obama's policies.
But Putin, of course, is very cynically, and the Syrian government and Hezbollah and Iran, just as these peace talks begin, they begin this massive offensive, which obviously took a while in planning. So it's not difficult to see how they're both offering the carrot and the stick. And the fact that the opposition has just walked out and now the UN is saying, well, we may come back on February the 25th. What moves can you in the opposition take?
We shall not go back to negotiations until the Russia that signed the resolution in the United Nations saying we will allow food to the 500,000 hostage in 14 different areas in Syria, food to be to pass. We're not asking Assad to pay for the food. The United Nations is sending the food. When the rebels take out the Syrian army positions, they find food supplies that the United Nations send to the Syrian refugee, to the Syrian displaced, 4.5 million displaced people in Syria. The United Nations has no choice but to send all aid and food to the regime in power. They can't deal with anyway. And the regime uses it to feed its army and starve the opposition, the areas that are not under their control.
So just in closing then, what are the options for the opposition?
We have no choice, but, I mean, the opposition has to have credibility with its people. And the people cannot accept that their representatives are sitting in Geneva in five-star hotels, eating, and not caring that the starvation is going on. Mm-hmm. And conducting negotiations with this criminal. That can't be.
Sure.
That's not looking for a credible solution. For us to sell the solutions to the people, we have to be credible, and we have to also look at human rights, and that's basic. Children have to eat. How hard is that? Is that negotiable?
Well, Dr. Max Sawaf, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Max Sawaf, who's a member of the Syrian National Council and a member of the delegation that met recently in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to select the negotiating team for the UN-Syrian peace talks that were suspended today in Geneva. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how we are trapped between a dying establishment and a new order that is not quite formed. And joining us now is Jonathan Taplin, the director of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communications and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career in 1969 as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band, and in 1973 produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Iowa Caucuses Deals Death Blow to the Establishment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Hi, Ian.
And in dealing a death blow to the establishment, or being the kind of yardstick or the indicator of the death of the establishment, you in your article at the Huffington Post, say that we're in an interregnum where the old is dying and the new cannot be born. And so what are we dealing with now? Sort of,
well,
symptoms?
It feels to me like we're in a very strange period in which, in four basic areas, we're in a major transition. And the first is in domestic politics. We see that we're kind of in a populist dead-end battle as the older white America invests its hope in Donald Trump and Ted Cruz to stave off a multicultural state filled with immigrants and young people. In the world of business, we see the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil fighting to preserve a business that's all based on extraction of oil, where we're really in a transition to a clean energy economy, and their business is going to be dying, but they're going to fight that. In Wall Street and in Silicon Valley, we see these businesses that have no regulation on them whatsoever, and which obscene fortunes are being made, and they're creating more economic inequality, and they don't want any different changes in taxes or regulation or antitrust. And finally, the military-industrial complex, where we have a world in which we all can see that we are entering a world of multipolar dynamics, and yet there is a huge investment in keeping the U.S. the sole hegemon, keeping the military budget at $800 billion a year to keep the military-industrial complex going. And so this is the dynamic I see happening in this election. And, you know, it may be that this is the last gasp for the establishment that wants to keep that old world going.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary that they've managed to raise the defense budget 60% more than was spent during the height of the Cold War against a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that could have wiped us off the face of the map. And recent polling indicates that the one issue that concerns most Americans, not it's the economy, stupid, but rather terrorism and security. How do you explain the fact that we are, because of our extraordinary power, military power, are the safest country on the face of the earth, yet the American people don't feel safe?
Well, I mean, one has to differentiate between essentially the issue of counterterrorism and the issue of having, you know, 200 bases around the world where we have, you know, military presence all over the world with very large aircraft carriers, jets, and all sorts of things which cost hundreds of billions of dollars to maintain. You know, not necessarily is that necessary to fight the threat of ISIS on our own soil. One would also have to argue whether our intervention, whether it's in Syria, whether it's in Libya, whether it's in Iraq, have actually been helpful or have actually created more chaos in the world and made us spend $1 trillion on something where we have nothing to show for it.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Taplin, the director of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Iowa Caucus Deals Death Blow to the Establishment. So if indeed the choice of the Koch brothers, either Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, who will dutifully lower the taxes of America's plutocrats, they'll stop efforts to address global warming, and they'll throw more money at the Pentagon, as you point out in your article. And, of course, you do have the phenomenon, as you mentioned earlier, of Donald Trump. But and the one thing about Donald Trump that appears to be different is, in terms of his populism, he's drawing a lot more people out of the woodwork, if you will. And you point out in your article in 2012, in the presidential election, 93 million eligible Americans did not vote. So there's been an assumption for the longest time, if more people voted in this country, they'd vote in their interests. But it may be that they won't vote in their interests.
Well, I mean, one of the issues that I try and raise in this article is the basic notion that people like Paul Krugman put forward, which is that the white middle class is all only fired up by kind of racist, nativist attacks, which, of course, is the center of Trump's play. Whereas Bernie Sanders tends to believe that really the issues are more about money, and that the Tea Party is motivated by the fact that there are people who are creating problems for them in the upper class. It's so interesting. Vox and Morning Consult conducted a poll just last week in which they posed the question, in the next decade, a political revolution might be necessary to redistribute money from the wealthiest Americans to the middle class. Do you strongly or somewhat agree, or strongly or somewhat disagree? In Tea Party supporters, 55% strongly agreed and 36% disagreed. In didn't vote in 2012, 58% strongly agreed. In independents, 51% strongly agreed. And overall, 54% strongly agreed and only 30% disagreed. So it seems to me that the center of the Sanders pitch is that actually the lower class and the working class is angry enough to actually be willing to change things in America. Now, the only question then becomes, will the nativist pitch of a Trump or a Cruz work, or will Sanders' pitch that really you're being screwed by the Koch brothers be one that will work? And this is the issue. Now, Sanders believes he can expand the electorate and get some of that 93 million who were eligible to vote to come and vote. And there was some evidence on Monday that a lot of new people came and vote, especially young people. So this seems to me to be the question that will play itself out over the next few months.
But what happens if Sanders fades, and indeed there's a possibility that Trump may fade? My sense is that you have to separate the messenger from the message. And surely in Sanders' case, the message might well live on. I mean, he is building a movement, even if he doesn't make it as a presidential candidate. Is there a possibility that the movement will live on? Just as, for example, on the right, Barry Goldwater had a very radical right-wing campaign, and he got trounced by LBJ. But in 16 years later, Goldwater's ideas came back in the form of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I definitely think the movement will live on. I mean, I make the point that we have to see the moment we're in as a transition moment, not an dead-end moment. In other words, the whole notion of an interregnum is we're in this transition. The old systems are dying, and the new is not yet born. So there's no doubt that movement can live on. And quite frankly, perhaps if Hillary Clinton wins, she will carry a lot of those issues forward. I mean, I personally have some doubts about the Clintons' willingness to regulate the banking industry. Certainly, I believe that Bill Clinton did not do that. In fact, I think he, in fact, helped deregulate the banking industry. And I have some doubts as to whether Hillary Clinton is not almost as much of a hawk as Marco Rubio is. And so that worries me. And I think the obvious place where one needs to look to find money to fund some of the things that Sanders has talked about, such as universal health care and free college tuition for people who can't afford it, is in the bloated $800 billion we spend on the military every year. Now, whether that can be accomplished now or whether it's going to take another 4 years and another 8 years is an open question. But I think at the end of the day, this is a transition we have to make.
Well, there's no question, I think, that both here in the United States and in Europe, you are witnessing the interregnum, if you will, with the establishment collapsing, whether it's the establishment on the left of socialist parties and the establishment on the right of conservative parties. The left is spinning off into Podemos and Syriza and the new leader of the Labour Party. And on the right, you've got UKIP on the right challenging the conservatives in the UK and Le Pen's National Front challenging the conservative in France, etc. So that it's happening there, and it's clearly happening here in the sense that you've got Donald Trump still the leader of the Republican insurgency, if you will, whose Republican credentials are pretty dubious. And you've got a leader who came in pretty much in a tie with Hillary Clinton, is likely to win the next primary on Tuesday in New Hampshire. He's the longest serving independent in the history of U.S. politics and a self-declared democratic socialist. So I can see all that happening. But in terms of money, just we talked about Bernie in terms of where does the money come from. Isn't the problem when you talk about the establishment collapsing, it's all about the money, isn't it? It's all about the plutocrats' money. It's about money in politics. It's about Citizens United. So how do we create a new system that's not based on money, that's based on candidates' ideas and policies?
Well, first off, let's be clear. Both Cruz and Rubio are people that the Koch brothers would be very happy to have as president. They would cut their taxes. They would make sure that nobody fights global warming and makes them stop polluting the rivers and the air from their energy plants. So, I mean, they are creatures of the establishment as much as they'd like us to believe they are not. They are people, if you look at the super PACs that are funding them, they're funded by hedge fund billionaires to the tune of $40-50 million each. And so that's not true. Now, look, I do believe that Sanders is actually running a campaign with just small donations, and he has no super PAC, and he has done remarkably well. Nobody has as many donors as Bernie Sanders says. He has almost 1,400,000 donors, each of which have given him about $25. So that nature of his campaign is truly radical. And in that sense, I do think he is running a revolutionary campaign. For myself, who was an Obama supporter in the last two elections, I must say I've been disappointed by the fact that Obama at some point became a creature of the establishment by appointing Tim Geithner and Larry Summers as his Secretary of Treasury and his economic advisor, and by appointing Bob Gates as the Secretary of Defense. He kind of went along with the old thing. So my sense is Sanders wouldn't do that. Now, is Sanders the best leader for this movement? I don't know. Obviously, I think Elizabeth Warren might have been a better leader, but that's, you know, we've been dealt these cards, and my sense is we have to play them.
Well, I was, though, thinking in terms of when you brought out the point about money, and it does seem to me at the end of the day, when you talk about the establishment collapsing, it's collapsing under its own weight of greed and money. That's the perception that I have. You've got Citizens United, you've got these super PACs, you've got these hedge funds, you've got these billionaires, you've got the Koch brothers, you've got the fact that Wall Street is more and more a self-serving organization that doesn't really do what it was originally supposed to do, which was invest in growing and nurturing enterprises, but rather it's all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And it seems to me that in a kind of, you know, perverse, poetic way, that the establishment is collapsing under the weight of its own greed and money.
I think that's really true, Ian. And you know, obviously, if there really was an establishment, Jeb Bush would be winning. But he's thrown $50 million at TV ads, and nobody cares. You know, it's really something new is happening here. And it's very clear that there is a great deal of anger in abroad in the land, and just how that gets harnessed is what's so fascinating for me. That's why I think Gramsci's notion that, you know, in this interregnum there are all these very morbid symptoms. It's a really chaotic time. The question for me is, how long will it take for this to play itself out? Because I make the argument that at the end, in 2040, nobody can doubt that America will be a land where there is where white male Caucasians or white Caucasians are in the minority in America. Nobody can make the argument that we won't have to be on a less carbon intensive energy system. Nobody can make the argument that we won't have to accept the fact that the Chinese are a major global power and we can't push everybody around the way we want to and the way we have for the last 70 years. So this is what I'm saying is a new world is coming, and it's just a matter of questioning how long the resistance is going to be before we get there.
And in the interim, the real is it a battle between whether we will have left-wing populism or right-wing populism, because one of the lessons of history, unfortunately, is that as people become disgusted with democracy, and we have no question that the American people are sick of Washington, the Congress has about an 8% approval rating, gridlock, polarization, etc. People are fed up. But normally, as are the cases in Europe in the 1930s, when democracy fails, more illiberal forms such as fascism emerge. I'm not suggesting that fascism is emerging here in the United States, but a form of right-wing populism is certainly emerging with Donald Trump. So is it a battle between Bernie's populism and Trump's populism that you foresee?
Yes, I think it is a battle in that sense. But I do think that at the end of the day, you know, I cite the example of the 1850s when we had a party called the Native American Party, which grew out of the Whigs, that basically said, we have to ban all European immigrants from coming here because they're all controlled by the Pope. So all the Italians, all the Eastern Europeans, all these Catholics coming in here, and they were called the Know-Nothings. And at the end of the day, Abraham Lincoln and his colleagues rejected that thesis and created a party called the Republicans that opened itself up to new voters and a new world. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves now is, you know, are we going to kind of surrender to this nativism that Trump has put forth or not? And my sense is Trump is going to collapse. I really do. I think his whole thing was based on his notion of being a winner. And now, as we can see today, he's a sore loser. He's trying to say, oh, we have to do the game over again because I didn't win. And people don't really like that. And it could be that his collapse is actually faster than anyone knew. But then we have to understand, well, what comes next? Is it Ted Cruz? Well, equally worrisome politics, and same with Marco Rubio. So I don't know. It's a very strange time. The thing I do know is that we spend almost 60% of our discretionary budget on the military, and that is unlike any other country in the world. And we spend 8 to 10 times more than any other country in the world spends on defense. And if we didn't do that, we could afford to fix our roads and bridges and have college, free college for people who couldn't afford it. And we could afford to have universal health care like every developed country in the world. And the fact that Sanders is raising some of these questions are good questions to ask. I mean, clearly, he's going to be tarred as a socialist and all that, and maybe he's not the perfect messenger, but I think the questions he's raising are good ones to ask.
Well, just in closing then, Jonathan Taplin, will this, do you think, is there revolutions? And of course, I was watching Chris Matthews last night talking with Hillary Clinton, and Chris Matthews kept really beating up on Bernie Sanders for using the word revolution, and they're saying this country isn't about a revolution. Revolution usually conjures up the idea of the French Revolution and blood in the streets. How do you see this revolution in terms of the way it's alarming people like Chris Matthews?
Well, look, it's unfortunate, but Chris Matthews has become a shill for the Clintons, and that's his choice, you know. I mean, he should probably just identify himself as that at the outset. But the notion of revolution that Bernie Sanders is talking about is not a violent overthrow of the existing order. It's a rather peaceful revolution. And all we have to ask ourselves is look at the budget chart that is in the article in the Huffington Post. Do you think it makes sense to have 60% of our budget go to the military, or should we maybe reduce some of that and put it to things like education, healthcare, and other things. Would that make more sense in terms of how you were spending your own household budget? Would that make more sense? That's the revolution Bernie Sanders is trying to get people to think about. Is that revolutionary? It doesn't sound that unreasonable to me. It sounds kind of rational.
Well, I agree with you, and I'm afraid we've run out of time. But I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Taplin, who is the director of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Iowa Caucus Deals Death Blow to the Establishment. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking at Jordan, a country whose King Abdullah says has reached a boiling point.
تني بجوز عيونه خالص ما راح الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gillian Schwedler, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She is currently completing a book titled Protesting Jordan, Law, Space, Dissent. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gillian Schwedler.
Thank you.
And the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, made an extraordinary statement to the BBC in London ahead of this donor conference over the issue of Middle East refugees that begins in London on Thursday. He said that his country's at a boiling point because of it's overwhelmed by all of these hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees. So do you think he's going to get the attention he needs?
That's a great question. He certainly stated as starkly as he can. In the interview for the BBC, he's very articulate in saying, we have been taking them in. It's time you need to help, you know, support us in this endeavor. And Jordan has been taking, you know, hundreds of thousands, 635,000, as you know, registered, and they claim as many as a million others, some of whom came in prior to 2011, but already a country with a lot of refugees from Iraq and, of course, the Palestinian refugees in the past. A million and a half new refugees fundamentally changes the demographics of the country. So I think he stated pretty clearly that, you know, we really need help on this. And I'm not sure he's going to get as much as he hopes. Hopefully he'll get some kind of increase, but the international community seems to be stretched in many directions right now.
Well, just to quote King Abdullah, the psyche of the Jordanian people, I think, has gotten to a boiling point. It hurts us when it comes to the educational system, our health care, and sooner or later, I think the dam is going to burst. So, you know, Jordan is always considered a kind of island of stability in a neighborhood that's pretty rough, and it's always taken in refugees, whether it were the Palestinians, who are a substantial section of the population, or more recently the Iraqis, and now the Syrians. So, you know, you can't have it both ways in terms of the international community, can you? You can't sort of celebrate a place as an island of stability at the same time not help it as its very stability is being threatened.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, particularly because Jordan has borne the brunt of, you know, many conflicts over the years. But the impact of the Iraqi refugees really put a strain on the system before the Syrian refugees even came in. And it is the education, which is flooded, and also health care. But other things such as a lot of, you know, refugees that made it into the city, Iraqi refugees and Syrian refugees who have made it into the cities and urban centers, many are living with relatives or in makeshift homes where they're tapping into the electricity illegally, and so you're having problems with the electrical grid in ways that hadn't been before. And so the infrastructure is just being taxed in an extraordinary way at a time when it's not simply, you know, strains on the infrastructure, but, you know, it's concern. And, you know, I'm not one to want to defend Jordan because I think it does a lot of things that it could be doing a lot better on human rights. But nonetheless, it's trying very, very desperately to prevent ISIS from getting a toehold in the country. And Jordanians are really nervous about that as well. I think that from what I'm hearing, the biggest concern about the Syrian refugees has to do with the ISIS question.
Well, that specifically, I take it, is to do with the 16,000 Syrian refugees that are in an area, I think, just across the border. And the Jordanians are saying we're not going to necessarily let them in unless they've all been screened because they believe a number of them belong to Daesh, the Islamic State.
Yeah, so that's their claim, of course. I mean, I only know what I'm hearing in the news and from human rights groups as well. But the claim is that, you know, there's some, you know, 16,000 there. It is in a, you know, ISIS-controlled area, a Daesh-controlled area, and so it's incredibly reasonable to believe that something in Jordan would be a prize for Daesh to be able to accomplish. And so Jordan's very concerned about that, as it should be. And so it's vetting these coming in from that area very, very carefully. The king in the recent interview said that he was they were letting in children first for health care, but not everyone was being able to remain in Jordan. Some were then being sent back, the elderly and women. But he pointed out in the interview, the BBC interview, that women have been involved in bombings, as we know from Paris and elsewhere. And so you can't have this automatic assurance. And as I said, I really think that Jordan is going to be a prize target. Daesh hasn't been able to carry out a major attack there. And I think there definitely have been ones that Jordan has foiled. And so I think part of its game is to see if it can get something done there. And it scares the regime, the Jordanian regime, and it really does make the people very nervous. From what I'm hearing talking to people there, it's a real concern.
And again, I'm speaking with Gillian Schwedler, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. So obviously, though, all of this goes back, surely, in terms of responsibility to the Assad regime in Syria. And what's your sense of how these peace talks, which finally seem to be getting underway, have in terms of getting at the root cause?
It's a difficult question. Again, I'm not a specialist on Syria, but from the conversations I'm hearing, especially through people in Jordan, there's simultaneous concern about, and there's happy that the peace talks are going on because so many parties in Syria, you know, regime and anti-regime, have a common interest in taking care of some kind of solution, because a solution is really going to be the best way to forfend against the expansion of Daesh. But there's a lot of anger at Bashar al-Assad being at the table and the crack being opened, that the possibility that he could remain in power is something that's not sort of familiar U.S. betrayal and foreign betrayal of let's go back to these old stable regimes, however horrible they are. And there's a lot of concern about that.
Well, it's not just the U.S., it's Russia and the U.S., it appears, if that charge is accurate. I certainly believe it's felt by the Syrians who feel they're being sold out. But the Russians have a very cynical position there. They'll just prop him up till the cows come home, as long as they can keep their bases there, and they'll bomb the hell out of that country, just as they did in Chechnya. So,
yes, certainly. And I think the concern for the critique of the United States was the sort of the United States hinting that the possibility of Assad remaining, which is a backpedaling for the administration, which said he must go. So to hint that he could remain, people see as a sign, a signal to the Soviet, or to the Russians, that they can therefore go ahead and prop up the regime. And, you know, certainly that's what we've seen in the past, you know, couple of days, a significant effort to sort of say, absolutely, he's going to stay, he's going to be part of the solution, regrettable, but he's going to be there. And so I think the Russians have seen that as an opening. But from what I'm hearing, it's the U.S. is hinting that that's a possibility, is where people are feeling very critical. They expected Russia to support Assad as long as they could. But here is the U.S. saying it's a possibility, and that feels to be another betrayal.
But clearly, with that influx of Syrian and Iraqi and Afghan refugees into Europe, and it's still continuing, but the strains that that's put on Europe, it must have raised the questions that maybe it makes more sense to keep refugees closer to Syria in the hope that the war can end and that they could return home just across the border as opposed to settle in Europe and never come back?
Yeah, I think particularly from the European and the U.S. perspective, it's a new kind of a policy of containment. Like, let's send them aid, let's help them, let's help improve the situation over there, but keep them over there. I'm following the Yemeni situation close as well, and one of the things you're hearing frequently is we don't want the Yemenis coming over here also. No more boatloads of refugees, and we don't know what we're going to do with them. And, of course, the fear that they bring this sort of radical Islamism with them. So that's absolutely the case, but I don't think it's a perspective that allows a real solution for the region. If you're going to keep people contained and living in poverty, you're only going to, you know, maintain the breeding grounds where this kind of thinking comes from. There aren't easy answers, is the bottom line to this, as we all know. But I think it bears pointing out that the humanitarian devastation is extraordinary. And I think the world, particularly, you know, having played a role, a long-term role over the decades, but having played a role in a lot of the regimes that are there, bears some responsibility in taking care of the people that are now suffering.
And where does do you think King Abdullah stands in terms of his authority? I mean, I don't imagine there's any diminution of it in the UK, for example. But he's had his certainly had his problems with the Bush administration, didn't he? He tried to warn Bush against the folly of invading Iraq, and Cheney basically cut him out of the loop.
Yeah, very much. And I mean, I think he has a much better relationship with the Obama administration. The visit a week and a half ago, or 2 weeks ago, I believe now, where it was initially said he was being slighted by Obama, and that turned out not to be the case, and they hastily pulled together a brief meeting to show that they're in touch. They seem to really have great relationships. I've been critical in the past because I feel that Obama and others have bought into the being grateful for this stable regime that can talk to us in a way that sort of neglects all the human rights violations there, the reintroduction of the death penalty, including some summary executions. I think a lot of that has been silenced. But I think the Obama regime sees Jordan for a stable, for the moment, place that must remain stable. And so I think they have a very good relationship. They both repeatedly comment that they're in regular touch. They pick up the phone and talk to each other. And I don't think we have any reason to think that's not the case.
So what's the situation then with this considerable Palestinian refugee population? I believe the king's wife's Palestinian, isn't she?
Yes, she is.
So given that there's nothing happening across the border in Israel and nothing likely to happen, and it does seem at some point or other there could be a new intifada because of the level of frustration that the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza feel. So what's your sense of whether that's another shoe that might drop in this incredibly complicated situation, given what we've been talking about with this overburdened small country flooded by refugees from Syria and from Iraq?
Do you mean a Palestinian rising in Jordan?
Yes.
Or
well, I imagine, you know, first of all, in the Palestinian territories to begin with, and how that would influence or affect the Palestinian population in Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a possibility in Palestine, the Palestinian territories. Every time I visit, I'm amazed that people aren't constantly protesting, and it's gotten absolutely consistently worse over the past decade, as you know. And so there's always a possibility for that. Of course, the repression has gotten worse as well. One of the interesting things vis-a-vis Jordan, and of course there's always that potential of a spillover into Jordan whenever there are significant protests or uprisings or repression on Israel's part, in Israel and Palestine, Jordanians take to the street in large numbers. And you've seen this in 2002 with Jenin. You've seen this in 2009 Gaza. So there's definitely that potential. There's two interesting things that are related. One is that the Palestinians that want to come from Syria are not being allowed into Jordan. There are some that are in an area, I believe it's called Media City, but an area, a small, which was kind of a gated community, which was given over to house them on a temporary basis, from what I understand. But they're not being allowed. They're told in no uncertain terms will they be able to integrate into Jordanian society. So there's that no more Palestinian question, which is significantly forgotten as we focus on the much higher numbers of Syrians. There's that Palestinian question. And that's something I hear about, you know, among people in Amman talk about that. The second is with the sort of uprising, protests, et cetera. I mean, Jordan has a long history of a active, you know, sphere of political dissent and expression on the street, and, you know, had its own Arab uprising in 2011. It didn't come together to threaten the regime. But what's very interesting is, with some exceptions, but even many of the voices most critical of the regime are fairly quiet right now because of the big concern of ISIS spreading into the country. In a weird way, they want security. They want the regime to protect them. And so I think it's unlikely, with that fear looming as high, for there to be a popular, a large-scale popular outburst on the streets in terms of protests, at least for the time being.
But meanwhile, Jordanians feel squeezed and overburdened by the influx of refugees that's impacting their school system, the infrastructure, power grid, etc., jobs, more and more taking jobs away from Jordanians, and the king's trying to, at this donor conference apparently, get some help for giving jobs to Jordanians who are losing their jobs. So I can see, you know, when you think about our politics, you know, the old adage that it's the economy, stupid, that's also a point of possible explosion.
Absolutely, absolutely. The strain goes back again from the Iraqi refugees in 2003, particularly beginning in 2004, which put tremendous strain on the country. What also happened under this king, who came, you know, who's now some more than 15 years in power, is there has been a increase in luxury boom, building up of parts of Amman, this effort to create a very cosmopolitan city that has pretty much destroyed part of the middle class. That wasn't the goal, of course, but you now have very high-end luxury buildings that are, many of them aren't owned by Jordanians, many of them are owned by Gulf, people living in the Gulf or outside for investment. You also have these enclaves that have been taken over, private malls built where it used to be public spaces that people feel very much excluded from. And so the cost of renting an apartment is up, the sort of ability to live in a middle-class life in the center of Amman is very, very difficult because rents are so high. Jordanians had long blamed Iraqis for that when the Iraqis came in, and the joke became the Iraqis were responsible for absolutely everything, from traffic to high rents to lack of rain. So it was kind of a joke, but it was true that they were blamed for everything. And now to add on top of this another set of refugees, it's become economically very, very difficult to have any kind of middle-class existence.
Well, Gillian Schwedler, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Gillian Schwedler, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.